In brightest day, in blackest night, no evil shall escape my sight. Let those who worship evil's might beware my power. Green Lantern's light.
Welcome to episode 10 of Green Lantern's Light, hosted by
J. David Weider,
Jeffrey Taylor,
and Michael Bradley. This is a podcast covering the very late Bronze Age and post-crisis adventures of the Green Lantern, but after this episode, I guess it'll only be post-crisis, at least as far as publication goes, because this episode we'll be looking at Green Lantern issues 196, 197, and 198. And we'll be touching on the final few issues of Crisis on Infinite Earths. The main title's connection to Crisis, as we mentioned last episode, is really kind of minor compared to other books, but it does have a rather significant impact on the Green Lantern Corps, and these three issues we're getting ready to talk about go a long way towards bringing that to a head.
Oh, you mean the end of Crisis turned out to be important?
No. Not at all.
Aren't you the guy that hosts From Crisis to Crisis?
Oh, yeah. Right.
Awkward.
So the first issue we're going to look at is Green Lantern, issue 196, with a cover date of January 1986. And it was released around October 17th, 1985, for 75 cents. Our cover is by Howard Chaykin, and it shows Guy Gardner raising his ring, and the text reads, "He is the new Green Lantern." And Guy replies,
"And don't you forget it.
Don't you forget it."
Our Sorry, story, I figured it should be said by a redhead.
Okay, that works. Our story inside is simply called Three. It was written by Steve Englehart, Joe Staton penciler, Bruce Patterson inker, Lois Buchalis letterer, Anthony Tollin colorist, and Andy Helfer editor.
It does occur to me at this point that we should mention that the last two issues were called 5 and 4. This one is 3. And we do have 2, 1, and even 0 to get to in this episode. So right. This really will be its own kind of self-contained ending to the Green Lantern version of Crisis in its own way.
Yes. So to get into the story, freshly minted Green Lantern Guy Gardner returns to Earth, relishing in his new lease on life and ready to use the power to lay a little smackdown on pretty much anyone that gets in his way. Meanwhile, Hal Jordan returns to Earth. He moans about the Guardians not giving him his ring back, but resolves to fight for the future, power ring or not. Meanwhile, thinking the Anti-Monitor is dead, Green Lantern John Stewart also returns to Earth and meets up with Green Lantern Katma Tui. After a little kissy face, Katma shoots herself in the face with her power ring, but finds her energy twin is blocked from returning to Oa, which means that the crisis isn't over. Back with Guy, the Green Lantern plunges into the ocean depths, looking for an accomplice to help make him the universe's sole Green Lantern. Using his ring to warp time back over itself, Guy resurrects the shark.
Yay!
The beast attacks and uses his mind powers to keep Guy at bay. Guy tries to flee, but the shark again uses his mind powers to transform into a 50-foot-tall giant. The shark grabs Guy, monologues for a bit, and then tosses him aside, deciding to go after the real Green Lantern. In his apartment, John tucks Katma into bed, and then gets a visit from Hal Jordan, who reveals that he was the former Green Lantern, and offers to put his experience at John's disposal. The two men talk, filling each other in on the events of Crisis, Guy's backstory, the actions of the Guardians, and no doubt the awkward racism of John's first appearance. And eventually, John decides to check out the barrier around Oa himself, so he likewise shoots himself in the face, sending his energy twin across the universe, and realizes something must be wrong. Which he really should have known from when they established it earlier, but whatever. When John returns to his body, he finds Hal being attacked by... the shark. John grabs Hal, encasing him in an emerald bubble, and shoots him into outer space. John then quickly gets the upper hand on the shark, attacking him with a dolphin construct. Because, remember, sharks are afraid of dolphins. The shark counters with his mind powers, but finds John fears nothing, meaning his mind powers are useless. John then encases the shark in an emerald bubble, depriving him of oxygen. And off-panel hopes that he didn't screw up, and that the same thing didn't happen to Hal. Before John can give that any thought, though, Guy suddenly appears, saying that he needs... the shark. As he's, quote, gathering the toughest creeps in the cosmos to destroy the Anti-Monitor's home base. Because if there's one guy you want fighting beside you in the outer space of another dimension, it's the shark. Anyway, despite having established twice that the crisis is still on like Donkey Kong, John says, the Anti-Monitor is dead, dude. But Guy says he got his orders from the Guardians themselves, and if John wants to stop him, he'll have to do it power ring against power ring. To be continued.
Well, be careful. Unlike Donkey Kong is now, like, copyrighted or something.
Oh, really?
I don't know. Supposedly. Hmm. I doubt we'll be found, so it's fine.
Yeah, probably not, yeah.
I don't think it actually was successful. I don't remember what happened with it, but somebody did try to copyright that term.
Sounds like a bunch of monkey business to me.
Yeah, a little bit. So if you don't mind, I'll jump right in with my notes.
Go for it.
First off, I really do like this cover. It's a little bit rougher than what we normally see for these covers. It's got a pretty thick outline to it, but I really like this cover. I was drawn to it when I found it in a dollar bin, and I just had to get it, especially since it's got Guy Gardner on it. And I didn't think it was his first appearance or anything, but I thought it might be a really good Guy Gardner issue, which it kind of was. Unfortunately, I think this was the weakest of the three issues we're going to be talking about today, but at least that means that we're only headed upward and onward.
That seems to be the pattern lately. We have a weak issue at the beginning, and then the other two get a little better.
A little bit, yeah. So I really do like how this is called Three, that's the title, but we actually have in the beginning three different stories, and they all begin with the title of Three. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the point. So for pages 1, 2, and 3 of this issue, we've got Guy in his full belt-buckled GL suit. And there's already some hinting about the kind of Green Lantern that he's going to be. And we will explore a lot of that over the course of this episode. But of course, he will continue to be the way that he is. But this is the beginning of that, because he was not like this back when he first appeared. Pages 3 and 4, I'm really interested to see what's happening with Hal at this point, because it seriously looks like he'll never be a Green Lantern again, even though we know that he will at some point down the road somewhere. Page 5, it looks like it's sort of that lull in the Crisis on Infinite Earth story where everything seems briefly like it's okay, even though there's still some issues to go. And so I'm guessing that that's where this takes place, because I've not looked at them, I'm sorry to say. Well, at least not recently. Page 6.
At this point, they thought the monitor was destroyed and everything was done. So that's what John saw when he left. So. Mm-hmm.
And then moving on from there on page 6, I'm really glad that Cat Matui is helping out on Earth, but it did occur to me when I was reading this for the first time that, isn't she also the only Green Lantern for her sector? Shouldn't she check out some things over there, see what's going on? But then we get to page 7 and, oh, well, I guess that was covered after all. Did you want to add something?
No.
Okay.
You covered it.
Okay, good. These are just notes as I was reading through it for the first time. So, page 8, I'm sorry, John, but she's right. The crisis is not over by a long shot. There's still a lot to happen, even though there's less issues for it to take place in. But I think there were also a lot more crossovers towards the end as well. Page 9. Okay, no. I hate this part of the story. And it's not even because it's the shark, who I really don't care for. But no, I know that the Green Lantern ring is the most powerful item in the universe and all that stuff. But now it can take scattered atoms from what was once a living being and put them back together and reanimate them. Okay, if it can do that, why can't it bring people back from the dead who have just died and they don't need to completely reconstitute their bodies from atoms? Seriously lame. They could be bringing people back from the dead all the time.
Yeah, I had a similar note. I described it as insane. It just feels like Englehart just was making stuff up as he went along.
I'll go so far as to say that this is pretty stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Because, okay, if they need to bring the shark back to life so that they can have him do this thing.
They don't need to bring the shark back. There's never a need for the shark.
That's the point that I'm kind of growing to. If they need to bring the shark back because they're going to go and do this thing that we'll find out about in the next two issues, if that's what they need to do, no, that's the problem. It doesn't need to be the shark. For what they're going to do, it doesn't need to be the shark at all. It could be any Green Lantern villain. And they chose the shark and chose this really weird, messed up way to bring him back to life. And yes, there are some that are almost as messed up. Yes, I'm looking at you. What's his name? Jason Todd. Okay, so if you're going to bring somebody back to life, this is not how you do it, because it suddenly gives the Green Lantern ring a power that it really shouldn't have. It really doesn't have in any other circumstance that I can think of. It's just kind of painful to even think about.
Yeah.
But I mean, on page...
go ahead. I realize that the Green Lantern ring, they say it's only limited by willpower. But there needs to be some sort of restrictions on that, even within the confines of the story. You know what I'm saying? You know, you just can't be willy-nilly bringing people back to life
But they were radioactive atoms.
Shut up!
I can't get behind that. I'm sorry.
Page 10, note to self, if I'm ever being attacked by a Green Lantern in the water, pee to turn it yellow. Because that's what the shark does. He turns the water around him yellow. I know it's not with urine, but supposedly that'll work. Hopefully you are, you know, saving up. Hopefully it's early in the morning.
And that's one to grow on, yeah.
There you go. Page 11, the Guy Gardner that we know and love from later on would never just leave this fight because it got hard. And it bugs me that he's just flying away to say, no, come meet me up at air level. No. Knock him down where he is. You can still do that. And in fact, what he does, he could have done here. But oh well. Pages 12 and 13. Okay, this is where it actually gets way stupider than it was before. A giant shark. He makes himself huge. He can do that. Mm-hmm. Which is not something we will see when it would be helpful two issues from now. Just throwing that out there. And, he just guy live for no reason. And that just bugs the heck out of me. But page 14, John Stewart finally learns that Hal Jordan is his predecessor. Finally. And that there was a big build to that. And I am kind of glad that it was Hal coming out and saying it instead of John just finding out and then confronting him about it or trying to talk to him about it. I do appreciate that.
Agreed.
Although either one would have worked if it was set up properly. Page 17, jumping ahead a little bit. This energy twin thing, I know that we've seen it before. It's really convenient, and I'm sure it's been used before. But I don't get why Green Lanterns don't just do it all the time. Like, I can just sit and lie down in my bed and eat some popcorn while I send my energy twin. Seems like it should happen more often if it's that easy. Page 18, Okay, that is awesome. I really do like this one part of the issue where John brings his energy self back into his body, so he essentially wakes up from his body, and there's the shark about to kill Hal. Now I feed! It's actually a really cool moment, I thought. Page 19, the only problem with sending Hal out into space, as John does by putting him into a construct bubble that has air in it and sending him off out there, the only problem with that is that if John dies, Hal's going to die too. I think there are safer places on Earth that the shark can't just, you know, get to at a moment's notice. So it seems just a little bit weird, but of course it is leading to something, as we'll find out in the next issue.
Thankfully.
page 21, why not send the shark into space the same way he...
Because he has to be on Earth for what happens at the end of the issue.
Shut up. Both of you this episode. So he's got him in the exact same kind of sphere. Just send him off into space, and while you're at it, fast forward about 6 years and do the same thing with Doomsday. Yeah, guy, why not? But anyway, but I digress. Page 22, of course, Guy would challenge John to a fight, and he's already pretty close to the guy, Gardner, that we know and love, and will become more so. Well, you know, love is a... Sometimes we'd love to hate things, and in this case, that's how I feel about Guy Gardner. I know there are people who are huge Guy Gardner fans. I just find that the level to which he is arrogant is only superseded by the level at which he fails.
So. I like Guy when he's written well, and yeah. He's been not written well very, very many times.
Towards the end of the previous, I guess the post crisis era, he was starting to get to where you could balance the jerk with the. Basically, his actions could back up his words.
Mm-hmm.
There's some great stuff in the Justice League era that he is part of as well, but it's kind of a give and take. But that's pretty much all that I have. I have one thing to say about the letters page if Michael doesn't cover it. So, but that's it for me. How about you, David?
I love this cover. It says a lot about Guy. It's a great representation of him in image and in attitude with one simple word balloon, and you immediately know the guy. Page 2, there is a crisis. The entire universe is at stake, but Guy stops to jack up a small town for no reason.
Was there some significance to that building or that town?
Not that I caught, no.
Okay, because I didn't get anything either.
I jump to page 4. Hal decides he's really finished now. Hal and the Corps it's like a tumultuous relationship that everybody knows is right on the edge of ending at any moment, but just keeps the whole on and off again thing going for so long. It's like Moonlighting from the 80s or Sam and Diane on Cheers. For a while, the whole on again, off again thing is fun, but eventually you just want to say, figure out what you want. Just because you left your job for Carol and she turned out to be a complete psychopathic villain now living on another planet doesn't absolve you from living with the choice you made.
Right.
There's one other TV reference that I want to throw in there. Smallville.
Touché. Page 5, John returns to Earth, and we get this third sideway approach to Earth. We kind of get the same point of view from each one. And John's saying that, this cost some lives, but he looks at it as a victory. It's not the most compassionate viewpoint. Yeah, a few hundred people died, but everything, all in all, things ended pretty well. Page 6, I know Catman and John missed each other, and they weren't sure they would ever see each other again. I get that, but couldn't Catman finish fixing that igloo before jumping into his arms? But then again, I think, wait, this is the same duo that let Star Sapphire go, so a point retracted.
Yeah, it would actually be kind of funny if she just turned to go and hug John in that third to last panel and the rest of the igloo just fell over on the...
and she never really finishes it either, because they're making out and talking, and then they leave and go back to his place. We never see her finish it.
Able to do it for themselves.
And somewhere, Thomas Kalamaku's grandparents are a little upset. They're living in a damaged igloo. Page 7, John makes himself seem more daring than he was, because that particular mission ended badly when John's ring failed. And as far as fixing the gap, I haven't figured out how John survived, because in those issues, maybe it's in the Justice League, I don't have all the crossover, but he's suddenly just back. Because we have a scene where his ring is failing, it goes to black, and then Crisis moved on. Suddenly John's fetching Blue Devil for the Justice League. So I don't have the issues that kind of put point A to point B.
There was nothing in the Justice League issues that explained it.
Okay.
I am in the process of reading through basically the entire saga of Crisis on Infinite Earths, but it is like 100-something issues, so it's taking me a while. I'm not nearly far enough to be able to talk about that. But I have definitely noticed that this was a very early kind of line-wide crossover. It's hard to even look at some of the more current ones and say that any of them are even close to perfect.
No.
And this one, it seems like it's a prototype, sort of a beginning for what a crossover could be. And when it comes down to it, there are some really good crossovers that are very closely and tightly knit. And I'm especially looking at Zero Hour for that one.
Mm.
And this one, well, of course, that took place over 1 month. We're talking about a year when it comes to Crisis on Infinite Earths, even longer, really, when it really comes down to it. And to expect all of the writers to be talking to each other and all of the writers to be reading each other's work when that's not really a mandate yet, I can understand why there might be some mistakes here and there, or something where something ends in a way that when it picks back up in another title that it doesn't quite fit. And so I'm guessing that's what happened there.
Yeah, I just kind of shrugged and said, okay, it happened. Yeah, just kind of move on.
There's even the mask thing to consider, which I'm really glad that they did something about that. Like, by the way, you should wear your mask because you wore it in Crisis number 2.
Right.
Page 7, John makes himself seem more daring than he was, because that particular mission ended badly when John's ring failed. And if not for leaping aboard the Monitor ship at the very last moment, he would probably be toast. He'd be radioactive atoms, but Guy Gardner could put him back together, I assume. Page 9. You know, I actually had a different reaction to the shark, and it's all thanks to Len Wein talk about how ridiculous a shark is. So I was suddenly glad to see the shark this time. And kind of continuing that onto page 10, one thing I do like about the shark is that his psionic powers, they create an interesting match for the Green Lantern rings, because the full power fits whatever the plot needs. You need yellow water. Mental powers can do that. Change size, done. If not for the shark motif, a character with the same power set could actually be a pretty formidable foe that I would take seriously. I'm going to jump to page 15. Somehow, people actually awkwardly avoided telling John that he was placed on alternate Green Lantern status because Guy wasn't able to continue the job. So that would have actually gone something like, yeah, you were actually the alternate to the alternate.
Yeah.
I'm kind of glad they skipped that awkward conversation. And page 17, this is the moment where John clearly realizes that the Anti-Monitor is still around and the crisis isn't over. But we're still kind of catching up to where the crisis is at this point.
Well, he says the crisis is over, but then he says it's not, but then at the end of the issue, he says it is.
Yeah.
They go back and forth on it.
Page 18, crap, I did not expect that when I did the first reading. Comes back, the shark is there. This was just a really well-done attack, because we didn't see the villain pop into the window, tell the hero he's there to destroy, and then attack. We're just back, and all of a sudden, this has been going on. It's kind of slightly terrifying. That would be a very good movie technique. Page 19, when in doubt, fighting a villain, throw Flipper at him. Yeah, because sharks are scared of dolphins, apparently.
Yeah, it said no universe ever.
Yeah. And the final page was actually my favorite part of the book, and I don't mean that necessarily entirely sarcastically. But I'm ready to see John and Guy go mano a mano.
Oh, and so they do.
Yeah. So that actually ramped it up. Most of the issue was, oh, this is okay. That's okay. Oh, crap, it's going to go down. And that's where it ends.
Crap just got real.
yeah, it got real. So it's off to your thoughts, Michael.
All right. Well, since I've had no luck finding a bootleg of the Man of Steel trailer online while David was doing his notes, I will go back to my notes. I love this cover, too. I think it's maybe a little heavy on the inks, which attributes the kind of the wonkiness that Jeffrey talked about, but I like this cover a lot. In 2006, Chaykin wrote and illustrated a two-issue miniseries called Guy Gardner Collateral Damage, and the cover to the first issue was very similar to this.
I remember that. That was a prestige format. It was, what, three issues?
It was two issues.
It was two issues, right. And it was really overpriced for what you got, but it was prestige format. Why it was prestige format, nobody will ever know.
Pages 2 and 3, like I said, I'm not sure of the significance of the building that Guy destroyed. Maybe it was something that would make more sense if we've read every Green Lantern issue ever. Thankfully, they don't dwell on it, but it still felt random.
He just doesn't like Baltimore. I don't like Baltimore. I hate Baltimore.
Page 5, John doesn't get a quote? That's unfair. In the last few issues, since they started the countdown titles, like Jeffrey talked about, each title has been given a quote from literature that relates to the number. In this issue, when Guy was introduced, it had a quote from an Elizabethan manuscript, and Hal got a nursery rhyme, but John gets nothing. Pages 14 and 15, I liked John's reaction to Hal revealing himself as the former Green Lantern. It felt very authentic and very natural, both in the writing and the art, especially in John's facial expressions. I don't think that Joe Staton is known for his ability to render the perfect facial expressions like Kevin Maguire, but he did a great job, especially in the center panel on, I believe it was page 15. They don't have page numbers in this issue, which makes it really annoying. And also interesting here, we find out that Hal is quite a bit older than John, because Hal says John was around 12 when Hal got the ring. And I've always pictured them as being closer to the same age, but with the sliding time scales, ages really aren't too critical.
I've kind of felt the same way. So that would put Hal in maybe his 30s and John in his 20s. See, if he was 12, I mean, he could have been, in this version of the continuity, 19 or something. So maybe there's only a 7-year difference. But I've always thought of Hal, even when he got the ring, as being at least 23.
Yeah.
So there could be a decade's difference here.
Well, he had been with Ferris Air for quite a while. So he would have – he couldn't be 19.
Could have been a prodigy.
Good point.
Not a good point at all, really, but
I was being complimentary, Jeffrey.
I know, and I was being realistic.
All right. Pages 18 to 21, great art on these pages. The whole book, really. But these pages and Guy's fight with the shark from earlier were really excellent. Page 22, first meeting of John and Guy, and it's on. Overall, a decent issue. Maybe a little light on the story, but definitely solidly written and drawn. Had they used a different villain, maybe the Javelin or even Goldface at this point, I think it would have been a great issue.
I'd settle for Sonar.
Even Sonar, yeah. And my final comment, the Shark is a stupid villain.
Yeah, and even as much as Len Wein was able to kind of turn me around on his use of the Shark is still a stupid villain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the letters page, they mention that apparently the panels from issue 192 were redrawn by Joe Staton. In the letters page here, there's a letter from Carl Caffarelli of Buffalo, New York, who wrote in saying that he enjoyed the art but would have rather seen the original panels reprinted or Staton to do his own takes on the scenes. And the response is, to tell the truth, Carl, we would have liked to reprint the original panels, but their shapes and sizes varied so much that it would have been impossible to make them fit on the page, at least without driving production boss man Bob Rozakis stark raving mad. We discussed the possibility of Joe doing the flashbacks in his own style, but decided to do the mimicry of the original artists as kind of an homage to their input in the Green Lantern mythos. So I was happy to get clarification on that, and really big credit to Staton to be able to pull off, emulating the other artists' styles so flawlessly.
it's always interesting to see when somebody is able to do that well.
Yeah. And Alan D. Michael of Albuquerque, New Mexico wrote in, disappointed that Hal is still such a big part of the book now that John is Green Lantern, and he says that he wants John to get his own series, which he eventually does, but not for another 6 years or so. So.
And it only lasts a year and a half.
Yeah.
But it was really good while it did last.
Mm-hmm.
There was one letter that I thought was really kind of cool. It's from Jesse Hochstadt of Brooklyn, New York. And he says to Andy Helford et al., I hope it's not too late to submit a nice short list of possible new titles for the Green Lantern's letter column, which, and he has a whole list of them. I want to read just a couple of them because some of them are kind of funny. Beware Our Power, The Reader's Right. I think it would make a horrible letters column title, but it's kind of amusing. I like the next one, Dateline Oa. Oa Opinions, Emerald Expressions. I love this one. Emerald Epistles by Emerald Express. Let's see. We have Verdant Verbiage. There's a few others. Return to Sector 2814. Let's see. Illuminated Letters. The Lanterns. Oh, the Central Battery. I like that
one. That's nice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's it for the ones I want to take the time to mention. He did list a good twice as many as I talked about, but not all of them are as gold as those.
You know, alliteration can be overused.
Yes.
I'm just saying. It's a great skill to have. It's a great tool to use, but stop overusing it.
But Billy Button bought a bunch of beautiful bananas.
I have no reaction to that. I should, but I don't.
Lily Langtree lay on the lawn and languidly, lasciviously laughed.
This is what happens when you get grammar nerds together.
Yeah, no, I prefer more the play on words than necessarily alliteration. Like, I am a mother pheasant plucker. I pluck mother pheasants. I am the meanest mother pheasant plucker ever to pluck a mother pheasant.
Okay, well, we're going to take a break. A promo for a show that you should listen to. Maybe that podcast host will also come up with some interesting alliterations for their recaps. But then we'll come back, and either David or Jeffrey, I forget who, but one of them will tell us about Green Lantern number 197.
In the decade of the 1970s and 80s, not even the great city of Metropolis could be spared the ravages of an energy crisis, super criminal attacks, or disco. The job of protecting the city fell to Superman, whose battle for truth, justice, and the American way made him a symbol of hope for the city of Metropolis. Charlie Niemeyer, in association with the Superman Podcast Network, presents Superman in the Bronze Age. Superman in the Bronze Age is a bi-weekly podcast highlighting the Bronze Age adventures of the Man of Steel in various comic titles. Follow along at www.supermaninthebronzeage.com.
So after that promo, we're going to take a look at Green Lantern number 197, which has a cover date of February 1986. It came out November 21st of 1985. Because remember, these are actually still 4 months ahead of the cover date. Also, this one came out for 75 cents. The title for this is, of course, 2, since we've already explained how the titles work. And as the recap goes, Guy Gardner tells John Stewart that the shark is coming with him, but John won't let him go. So it's a battle of the power rings, and they fight and banter for several pages, which I'm not going to recap entirely, until Stewart realizes that the shark is running out of oxygen in his airtight bubble construct. So John takes a moment to poke a small hole in it so that the shark won't die. But of course, the shark breaks free, which takes John's attention away just long enough for Guy to get the upper hand and pin John to the ground. The shark is about to attack Guy, but he quickly explains that he needs his help, as well as the help of other villains. So they need to track them down in order to go blow up the white spot on the black moon of Quard in the antimatter universe. And that's where the anti-monitor first came out of during Crisis on Infinite Earths, and destroying it will supposedly stop the crisis. After they leave, John struggles and tries to break free and go find Hal Jordan, and he finds the bubble in space, but Hal is not in it, and he worries that what may have happened. Meanwhile, Kat Matui's energy form reaches her home sector, but there's nothing but death and carnage, and it turns out that some of the people were saved by Salak, the sort of senior Green Lantern. But other Green Lanterns like Ador and Zabora were killed. Things do not look good, but she thanks him for saving some of the people in her sector and goes back. There's a quick scene of Guy breaking into jail to retrieve Hector Hammond, and then he goes and gets Sonar, as well as Throttle and Blindside, and he brings them to a remote island to explain why it is that they're all there. Throttle and Blindside say that they don't save universes, so Guy threatens to kill them. So they decide to go along rather than die. Hammond introduces himself mentally to the others as their leader, so Guy decides to just leave him there. But since he's not going to be around, he needs somebody else. So he goes back to, I think it's the same prison, and he gets Goldface. Unfortunately, John just missed Guy, but he's able to catch up and follow just as Kat Matui finds him as well. Together, they surprise Guy and the villains and immediately get the upper hand. But just then, bum, 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 Hal Jordan shows up with a power ring, although not the uniform. He says, "Under authority of the Green Lantern Corps, I am obliged to oppose what you're doing." And it turns out that the Guardian, the one of the few that survived, found him in space when John had put him out there in that bubble construct, and he took him back to Oa. Hal goes on to explain that this Guardian disagreed with the other Guardians, but now with them gone, he wants Hal to have a ring, and they need all the help they can get with this crisis still going on. And he wants Hal to help Guy with his mission, but as a subordinate. Hal almost says no, but decides that it's worth it to go ahead and do it. So he takes the ring, and here he is. After being talked into it, John and Kat Matui let Hal and Guy, and the villains, go on their way to the antimatter universe. And they say they're good lucks. But after they depart, Sinestro appears and tells John and Kat Matui that the white spot on the dark moon right next to Quard in the antimatter universe must not be destroyed because it will be the end of us all.
To be continued.
Mm-hmm.
I'll kick us off. Starting with the cover, of course the cover looks totally Silver Age. I love that the old logo is back up there. Very reminiscent of Green Arrow, Green Lantern.
Yes.
The line work itself, a bit over the top, kind of creating a lumpy look, but I'm still, this issue would have grabbed me back then. Page 3, Hal and John turn to giant fists, dolphins. Guy pulls out a rocket launcher.
That says everything you need to know about Guy Gardner right there.
Yeah, it definitely telegraphs it. It's not bearing the lead. Page 4, somebody needs to fill John in on what happens when you place an oxygen-breathing being into an airless void. They usually die pretty quickly, and I just don't know what John planned on doing, even without Guy's interference.
I think he was going to leave him in there long enough till he passed out, and then he got distracted when Guy showed up.
Maybe. Page 5, Guy kind of plays some dirty pool. He throws a sucker punch. But that's what Guy does.
Well, yeah.
Page 11, I really like this sequence of snatching Hector Hammond. It's straightforward, it's fast, and it's actually oddly funny, despite it being kind of horrific at the same time. But as we find out, why did we get this at all? Why did we even acknowledge Hector Hammond if we're just going to shoehorn him out of the story immediately?
Yeah, I wondered about that too.
I was especially curious about that, because then we see him just kind of left on the beach. Hal and Guy leave him, John and Katma leave him, and there's just that same old Hector Hammond look on his face, because he's, you know, it sort of looks like he's in a coma, drooling and everything, because that's sort of his look. But it's just weird.
They just left him there. He's still there a few years later. We got distracted. Page 14. I thought the warden was a little too chummy with John, and then I realized the Green Lantern Corps, they're not looked at as a law enforcement organization. He's a casual superhero. Down the line, there's actually moments where a little bit of protocol is put in place with a Green Lantern. They are looked at as an official, somewhat official law enforcement. I forgot that this really wasn't part of the era. Page 17 and through 19, I'm a little on the fence about how I feel with the way Hal gets the ring, or at least the way it's presented. I know it happens in the same issue, so I don't feel that cheated. It's not a cop-out, but I could have used a little bit of buffer for Guy snatching villains and John chasing him, so that might have been placed a little bit earlier. And page 22, once again, I'm blown away by the end of the issue, because now Sinestro's back, and I'm sure he's going to lead to something awesome.
Oh, what could go wrong with Sinestro?
Nothing.
I really don't have too many notes for this issue, but I did enjoy it. I like, on the cover, I like that Hal, the guy who punches first and asks questions later, is the one asking for reasoned discourse. pages 2 and 3, nice fight between Guy and John. Jumping ahead to page 6, the shark is a heavyweight? Yeah, I'm thinking not so much. Page 11, the breakout of Hector Hammond was pretty horrific. It's a completely silent scene, except for the sound effect, where a guy drills through the wall, and then the horrified scream of the guard as he's bludgeoned by the shark.
Yes, that I've scene, got a similar note.
Yeah, for a 1986 comic book, 1985 comic book, that seemed rather dark. Page 12, sonar, throttle, and blindside. Well, this comic just improved by the power of none. Oh, and a racist jail guard. How nice. Page 14. John is trying to think of tough villains, and he starts with Dr. Polaris, which, okay, I can see that. But then he goes right to Goldface. Really?
I know.
Not Brainiac, Deathstroke, Zoom, Kite Man, anybody?
Kite Man!
Goldface is strong and durable, but that's about it. And really, the only reason he's a threat to Green Lantern is because he's yellow.
Well, it was Guy's idea, and he's not the greatest thinker.
He did just get out of a coma. Give him a break.
Okay. And at the bottom of the page, I like how it's an ongoing thing that people won't call Green Lantern, or won't call John Green Lantern ever since he took off the mask. I like how it's an ongoing gag. Page 16, great page of reactions from the various characters. And my last note is over on page 22, which is simply, uh-oh, this can't be good.
Exactly.
Overall, a fun issue, but it just really highlights the weaknesses in Green Lantern's rogues gallery.
Essentially, yes, and a lot of them do not make any sense whatsoever for going on this particular mission.
Right. Yeah, I had a note about that with the next issue.
Right. So the cover for this one, another good one in my opinion, same as... I really like the first one. I really like the next one even. Page one, of course, this was John and Hal. If it was John and Hal, they wouldn't be fighting, but having heroes fight each other is kind of its own convention in comics. But before reading, my money is – this is a note that I took before reading the issue. My money is on Guy for the win, but John for potentially defusing the situation and turning it into a team-up. So we'll see where that goes. Turns out I was right on the first point. Of course, John managed to, you know, beat Shark while Guy couldn't. And I think that says a lot. Guy was not able to beat Shark, but John could just do it. It was quick. Page four, with John's attention away from Shark, it's pretty clear where this is going once he pokes that hole in the construct bubble, that he's definitely going to break out. There's no question even. And page five, that's enough Bela Lugosi references from Guy. Wasn't funny the first time. Sorry?
Bela Lugosi reference.
Yeah. He had one in the last issue, and then he has one in this issue. It's the second to last panel on page five.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, while you're dancing with Bela Lugosi, because he's talking about the shark, because he's, you know, horribly misshapen and all that. Page six, even though it doesn't make any sense, it actually does make sense once you know Guy well enough. Sure, he fought the shark as soon as he brought him back to life, but he actually does need him for this assault that he's planning, which makes no sense. Except it's Guy, and once you know Guy, it does make sense. But we haven't really seen that much of Guy before this, so if we didn't know anything about his future, this still wouldn't make any sense. So I'm just pointing out the paradox. Although, the shark totally turns around, which is very uncharacteristic of him. He doesn't do anything that doesn't suit his own needs alone. Nothing else, except here he's like, yes, I will join your team of heroes and villains that will go off and do this very big important thing. He's never done that before. So again, just showcasing the villains. Page seven, and Hal's not in the bubble anymore. And I thought to myself, well, that sucks. Pages 9 and 10, I don't have much to say about this, but I'm glad to see... I'm sad to see Eddore die. The sort of giant amoeba-looking Green Lantern. There's a great scene on page 11 where they break out Hector Hammond. I love this scene because we have several very similar panels. It's just Hector Hammond sitting in his cell. You can see his bed off to one side, which he obviously can't get to on his own. He's got a sink and what looks like a water fountain on the other side. No, maybe that's a toilet. Toilet and a sink, probably. So Guy Gardner busts in with his ring, along with the shark, and Guy goes to get Hector Hammond while the shark brutally rips in half these guards, so that we actually see in the final panel it's them flying away and one of the guards with, like, you know, his whole bottom half kind of ripped off. He's just reaching up with his bloody hand trying to be like, no, don't go. You're not supposed to take Hector Hammond. He'll kill you. Spud, page 12. This is actually kind of like a Green Lantern Suicide Squad when it comes down to it. And eventually Guy is even going to say, you know, by the time we're done with all this, I'm still going to be Green Lantern and you're still going to be bad guys. So I'm still going to track you down and put you back in jail. But right now we're on the same side. But this is kind of like a Suicide Squad, except it's a bunch of Green Lantern villains, who most of whom do not belong in this situation in any way whatsoever. Page 14, yeah, Dr. Polaris, that makes total sense. He should totally be on the team that they're going to. No, they went with Goldface. I wasn't even sure who that was. I mean, I've seen him before, but I'm like, who the heck is Goldface? It just sounds like somebody who's supposed to go up against Green Lanterns. What good is he going to do in space against Guardians? I mean, really?
Even the Tattooed Man, I think, would be a better choice.
Oh, yeah. There are plenty of more, like, supernatural-based villains. I mean, Sonar, I kind of get. He might be the only one.
Except for the fact that sound doesn't travel in space.
You're right, but sound doesn't travel in space, but radio waves can. And sound are just really large waves that are the same as radio waves. So you're still right, but I'm still going to disagree with you is what I'm saying.
Fair enough.
Yeah, page 16. Now, that's a strange turn of events. Hal Jordan shows up with the ring. Of course, he's not wearing the suit. And he had a yellow collar on before, but now it's turned white. I've seen shit that'll turn you white. Because if he had a yellow collar on, how's he going to, York the Green Lantern ring? Nah, never mind.
That's why he went home and changed.
That's why he took so long to get
Universe
to
the... Universe is ending? I must change my shirt.
Mm-hmm. Page 18. This is a really epic speech because the Guardian here, he's talking about the endings. And this is truly leading up to an end of an era in two ways. Number one, the title Green Lantern, which we will get to in, I guess, two episodes, because this really is leading up to that. And two, the end of the entire DC Universe as it stands currently. So he really is talking about endings here, and it's a very, very cool speech. Page 19, they're sort of explaining that Guy's coma turned him into a jerk. I guess. Maybe he was conscious through all that, so he was just stewing in his own, brain crap mixture. I don't really know. But page 19, they're sort of explaining in the rest of page 19. It's kind of a cool story that Hal has been telling up to this point. But then aren't all the villains kind of seeing Hal in his plain clothes with no mask?
That's a good point.
This is going to continue for the next issue.
Wait a minute. That didn't even dawn on me.
Well, just the fact that he's showing up in what are his plain clothes. He doesn't have the Green Lantern suit on. He doesn't have the mask on. And the Shark is seeing him. Hector Hammond is seeing him. I think Hector Hammond already knows anyway, but I'm not really sure. Goldface is seeing him. You don't want Goldface to know that you're really Hal Jordan.
Maybe they're going to use the ring to warp time back over itself and erase their memories that it ever happened.
Okay, last time I'm going to say, shut up, you. But page 20, this is kind of interesting. Page 20, Ivan Sergeyevich Turgenev. He lived in the 1800s in Russia and was indeed the first really famous nihilist. And that's who Hal Jordan is quoting here. He says,
I didn't look that up because I figured you would.
Okay, yeah. No, I would have to. He says, every prayer reduces itself to this. Great God, grant that two be not four. And the thing about this guy, Turgenev, he mostly wrote plays and short stories. And the thing about nihilism is that it should not be confused with atheism. Not all nihilists are atheists, but most atheists are not nihilists. And by nihil, the word nihil, spelled the same way, N-I-H-I-L, it's Latin for nothing. So a nihilist is a nothingist. It means that there is nothing. And in fact, it was also a big thing kind of in Germany. They made fun of it a lot in that movie, The Big Lebowski, which I'm sure most of our listeners have seen because it's one of the greatest sports movies ever made about bowling.
Indeed.
Yes. But every prayer reduces itself to this. Great God, grant that twice two be not four. And that's to say that no prayer can ever become reality. And I still notice that for reasonable requests, the odds are still kind of 50-50, regardless of a supernatural God's existence or intervention. And Turgenev was saying that no prayer can ever become reality, which is kind of what I take issue with, because you can pray for it, and I do believe in the power of positive thinking. But that's about as far as I really want to take that. Did I make enough sense?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good.
Well said, actually.
Okay. By the time we get to page 20, the bottom left panel, I can see the Shark wanting to bite Hal's head, like, clean off. And I just get a really big kick out of that one panel. He's like, I want to eat that. And I still don't get why Hal can't put on the suit, but that's not something that we're going to have answered at all this episode. And for the final page 22, when Sinestro shows up, Damn, what an ending. And my first thought when I read this is, you know what? I bet Sinestro was right, and he doesn't want to see the universe destroyed by anybody.
What is wrong with Sinestro's boots in that page? They look odd.
They're just a V-cut.
Mm. All right. I'm sorry, I interrupted your notes.
No, I'm done.
Oh, okay. They've been in the letters page, they've been promoting a contest for readers to write in and identify all the flashbacks from issue 192. And in this issue, they say they got lots of entries, and 19 people were able to ID them all correctly. But the winner chosen was Alan Lind of Santa Ana, California. And he was allowed to choose his prize, either a free subscription to Green Lantern, an original Steve Englehart script, or an original Joe Staton drawing of the Green Lantern of his choice.
Oh, really?
Oh, I would probably get the script over the Joe Staton. I love Joe Staton, and I would love to get an original, you know, my favorite Green Lantern, but... Man, I would probably go with the original script just because it's a completely unique thing, even though the Joe Staton would be as well. Mm-hmm. What would you get, David?
I was leaning towards the sketch until you actually made a very good point. That is unique. But I would probably still stick with the sketch.
Okay.
My knee-jerk reaction would be the sketch, but then if I actually sat down and thought about it, I'd probably actually go with the subscription.
Oh, you lame ass.
Hey, comics aren't cheap. They're a whole 75 cents a piece.
75 cents is a lot of money.
Well, if anybody else got any comments about the letters page this time?
That's all I've got.
All right, we're going to take one last break and then come back, and David will talk about Green Lantern 198.
The funeral is over. Jonathan Kent is on the mend.
So, how's Clark's father?
Oh, much, much better.
Lois has returned home.
Lois, over here!
Harry, wife? Since when did you start meeting your staff at the airport? How'd you know I was returning on that flight?
A good editor checks out his hunches, Lois. I got a hot story of once you want straight away. I'm parked over here.
But just as Metropolis has learned to live without the Man of Steel...
I know, there was only one Superman, but Metropolis just hit the jackpot. Because we got four Supermen now, and nobody knows which of them, if any, is the real McCoy.
Four beings of incredible power and intellect have laid claim to the Man of Steel's name.
The last son of Krypton.
I live.
The Man of Steel.
Man of Steel coming through! Nobody move! This is a bus!
The Cyborg.
Yes, I'm Superman. I'm back.
The Boy of Steel.
Put me down!
Listen, pal, don't ever call me Superboy. Capiche?
The reign of the Superman is upon us, and so from crisis to crisis, a Superman podcast begins its epic coverage of this last act in the epic Death and Return of Superman saga. Every week, Michael Bailey and Jeffrey Taylor, along with the best and the brightest in the podcasting community, will cover this event in all of its forms, from the comics to the novelizations, to the audio drama, and beyond. Superman is back, but is any of them the real Man of Steel? Find out on From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, located at www.supermanhomepage.com and www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
And we are back to wrap up this episode with Green Lantern number 198, cover dated March 1986, but actually was released December 12, 1985. It is a whopping 48-page spectacular, which includes ads, which would have cost you $1.25, as opposed to $4.99 now. This is one, and of course zero, written by Steve Englehart, penciled by Joe Staton, inked by Bruce Patterson, lettered by L. Lois Buhalis and D.C. Weiss, the appropriately named D.C. Weiss, I should say, colored by Anthony Tolan, edited by Andy Helfer. The cover is Guy Gardner standing on the top of a small mesa with Sonar, Goldface, the Shark, and a legion of alien baddies looking down at Hal Jordan just below, wearing his civvies but bearing a ring. And Hal is surrounded by many fallen Green Lanterns, including Tomar Ree, Cat Matui, Aresia, and John Stewart. And Guy tells Hal, "Face it, Jordan, you are history." And picking up right where we left off with Sinestro, Cat Matui, and John Stewart on the beach, Sinestro retells his origin, which we've covered before, so I'm going to spare you, and explains the source of the crisis being Kronos tampering with the creation of time, and then insists once again that Hal and Guy's mission must be stopped or else all creation, not just the antimatter universe, will cease to exist. After some discussion, John reluctantly comes to agree with Sinestro, but how will they get to Oa to appeal to the Guardians because their energy forms are blocked? So John and Sinestro devise a way to pit John's green energy against the yellow energy of Sinestro's ring, propelling John across the universe. Meanwhile, Hal has a brief run-in with one of the alien criminals that Guy has added to his arsenal despite being in civilian clothes, and Guy blows Hal off after he congratulates Gardner on becoming a Green Lantern. John does make it to Oa using the yellow-on-green thrust and finds that many lanterns have already gathered. They had arrived to find the Guardians in the beam of energy before the power battery itself attacked them. John pleads his case to the Guardians, who insist that Sinestro is lying. Before John even has too much time to process why Sinestro would lie, despite the fact that he is a villain and his name is Sinestro, John realizes that the Nemesis has hitched a ride to Oa and is actually about to attack the dark spot of the moon, which would destroy the positive matter universe. The Guardians snag Sinestro before he can attack, and they are in the process of chewing Sinestro out when Tomar Ree speaks up, insisting that the Guardians are wrong. Turns out this is actually the battery itself, speaking through Tomar Ree, and explains that destroying the white spot on the antimatter moon would free the anti-monitor, not kill him. The battery learned of this when the anti-monitor briefly controlled it, as the Green Lanterns were also held in its stasis. Slowly, the Lanterns begin to remember this, as they were within the energy as well, and a Guardian actually remembers as well. So the die is cast, Gardner and Jordan must be stopped. So Katma is brought to Oa, conveniently, for the mission, and the Green Lantern Corps chases after two of its own. Speaking of, Jordan and Gardner take their ragtag crew across over into the antimatter universe, where they come under attack by the Weaponers of Quard. In the midst of the battle, Hal and Guy have a fight over killing, and Jordan refuses to follow Guy's orders, so Guy sucker punches Hal and takes his ring, leaving him floating lifelessly in space with the bodies of the slain Weaponers. The Corps crosses into the antimatter universe, charges their rings, and they find Hal, who has snagged a helmet and life support from one of the Weaponers' bodies. John outfits Hal with a construct of a life support system, and the Corps catches up with Guy and his ragtag band of renegades. And so the fight to end all fights begins. Katma takes on the Shark. Tomar Ree battles Goldface, while John and Guy throw down, with Weaponers attacking both sides. In the midst of the battle, Zax is shot with the yellow energy gun of the Weaponers, while another Green Lantern uses his eighth sense to stop an attack on John, sacrificing himself in the process. Guy is able to break away from the battle, getting to the moon where a ringless Hal, Jordan, pursues him, resulting in a momentary fight with Guy, who ends up being the clear victor when John shows up and engages Guy himself. The two pitch ring against ring, will against will for all the marbles, and John finally prevails, overpowering Guy. Just in time, a great light floods the antimatter universe and the multiverse as a whole, shaking it. Without a doubt, everybody knows the anti-monitor has fallen. The crisis is truly over. But the battle has had casualties like Zax, and Tomar Ree has been fatally injured by Goldface. In the end, Tomar Ri bestows his ring to John Stewart while returning Howell's ring to its owner. With his last words, Tomar Ri utters, "It is good," and dies. Hal rushes to his side, where John restores Hal's civilian clothes to his full Green Lantern uniform. And once a Green Lantern, always a Green Lantern. And the Corps is united in a sad victory. They have done their job and saved the day at any cost.
I will take point on this one. But I just gotta say, yellow on green thrust sounds dirty.
Yeah, things sound different read out loud.
Yes. this cover is far more epic than the lead up to it has been. And I don't mean that poorly to those issues, because I did enjoy them. But here on the cover, you see Guy Gardner leading an army of villains and monsters and the shark facing off against a decimated Green Lantern Corps and the one man left standing, Hal Jordan, which is quite epic.
Mm-hmm.
Page one, I love how the opening splash is the reverse point of view as the final page from last issue. Pages 2 through 4, I thought this was a pretty fluid and concise recap of Sinestro's history. Had I not been reading Crisis, I think I would have liked a little more, but we get the bare essentials here.
Mm-hmm.
Page 6, Hector Hammond, oops. They just leave him on the beach there. But also, so a Green Lantern ring is ineffectual against a yellow ring, but a yellow ring can be used to somehow boost a Green Lantern ring? What?
Yeah, shouldn't they cancel each other out? I had a note on that as well.
Well, it's kind of interesting to think about, because when it comes down to it, they are opposites. One comes from the antimatter universe, one comes from the regular matter universe, and so it could work more like a warp bubble like it would in Star Trek, where they mix matter and antimatter.
Hmm.
So the result would be a huge amount of power that would be probably enough to destroy a planet. But hopefully they're far enough away from Earth itself that it won't be a huge issue. I don't know what planet they're supposed to be next to here, because it's purple.
That's where the eight-eyed, one-armed...
One-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eater.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, I saw the thing coming out of the sky. It had one long horn, one big eye. Woo! I missed a shaking and I said, "Hoo-wee." It looks like a purple people eater to me. It was a one-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eater.
One-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eater.
A one-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eater sure looks strange to me.
One-eyed?
Well, it came down to earth and it lived in a tree.
Page... page 16. Actually, no, let's go to page 14. Not Sinestro's greatest plan ever.
Not so much.
Yeah. Page 16. Is there anything on Oa that doesn't have its own sentience? We've had a talking sand. Now we have a talking power battery. These issues, I like these issues, but it really feels like Englehart is just making stuff up as he goes along to fit the story he wants to tell.
Which can work as long as you do it the right way and maybe set something up before you actually reveal it. And in this case, I can almost understand the power battery being sentient. In fact, I can't imagine that this is the first time that that's happened. Talking sand, on the other hand, not so much. Sorry?
The sentient power battery way down the road, but that becomes relevant to the multiple colors of the core.
Yeah, spoilers. That's 2 decades away.
Yeah, touche. Yeah.
page 17, something is happening to Tomar Ri in that last panel, and I kept waiting for them to come back to that, but they never do, because he's hunched over and there's little lines like he's quivering or shuddering, and he's reaching up to clutch his head. I don't know what's supposed to be happening in it.
He's envisioning his own death later in the issue.
Could be. Page 18, I like how the Guardian says, "The majority wishes to retain our trust in the central power battery. There's only 3 of you. Yes, 2 of 3 is technically a majority, but it's usually not referred to in that way." Page 21, it's weird seeing Guy Gardner give this rousing go-get-em team speech. It's really, really weird. Page 22, even weirder is seeing Sonar fight aliens in space. Even the Shark or Blindspot or Throttle, these are all very street-level, Earth-based villains. And Sonar, you know, Sonar is just a guy who wants his country to be famous. He doesn't belong in outer space and other dimensions, which Jeffrey touched on, I guess, earlier this episode. Page 23, apparently Guy doesn't know or hasn't figured out yet that Green Lanterns can't kill with their rings.
Whoops.
Page 24, though this shows we're dealing with a much different depiction of Guy than we're used to, as he just leaves Hal to die in space. I mean, the guy that I'm used to, yes, he's a cocky jerk, but I don't think he would intentionally kill Hal Jordan, even if they're disagreeing.
I'll get to that in my notes.
Okay. Page 25, I loved the panel of the Guardians charging their rings with their oaths and the different oaths. I think that's the first time we've actually seen them use different oaths in one panel.
I think you mean the Green Lanterns charging their rings.
What did I say?
Guardians.
Oh, yeah.
It's okay. I was just clarifying for the audience.
Well, thanks. Page 35, poor Zax. If he was going to die, I expected it to be by getting stepped on.
Which would make it fitting when you think about Chip later on.
Now I'm sad. Page 36 and 37, I loved this moment at the end with the ring choosing John. I'm sorry Tomar Ri had to die to get it, but when I read it, it was an of course moment, because that's the one thing that John needed to solidify his worthiness for the Corps, for the ring to choose him. Even though being selected by the Guardians is just as good as far as becoming a Green Lantern, and I take issue with the fact that Katma says he was wearing Hal Jordan's ring because that implies that he stole it or took it, but for the ring to seek him out really gives a lot more credence to the fact that John belongs in the Corps every bit as much as Hal. Page 38, and I like the final page with the infinity symbol and the final tribute to their fallen comrade. It's a nice way to end the book. Jeffrey?
All right. So for my notes, I had a little bit less to say about this, you know, page per page, as an oversized issue, but it really did come out to about the same amount for each issue individually. It's very flashback / recap heavy, so I think that had a lot to do with it. But once again, we do get another really cool cover. Some of these characters that are in the background on either side of Guy, I don't remember him recruiting, and many of them I don't remember actually seeing in the issue, but that's okay for the cover. I actually don't mind it in this case. Excellent opening splash page. Really, really good. And the Joe Staton has really upped his game throughout this entire issue. Mm-hmm. It's an oversized issue, so you have to imagine that it takes quite a bit longer, 38 pages versus 22. But he's really upped his game and made the people especially look a lot better than they have in a couple of the previous issues.
I actually wonder if maybe the extra size didn't put him a little behind, or someone on the art team, because there's two letterers credited, and they've been really consistent in the last several issues about having the same creative team.
Oh, gotcha. I don't know, but
if he was rushed, you can't tell it in the art.
Yes, exactly. So on page 2, I love it when backstory can be talked about in what feels like an organic way, whether they're showing it in flashback or having it discussed. If you can lead up to the flashback in a way that just feels organic, I really appreciate that. And that means that it's really good writing. So I think that this team is really coming together at this point. Really good recap, I thought, of Sinestro's origin from Green Lantern number 7. As it was talked about then. And then on page 4, another really good recap about the monitor and the anti-monitor. And they have a lot to talk about to lead through all this stuff. So there's a lot of writing to go through. And by the time we get to page 5, poor John still doesn't know that most of the Guardians are dead. And it didn't even occur to me until then. Like, oh, I need to go and talk to the Guardians. Wait, aren't they mostly dead? They're only mostly dead. And his teeth are smoker yellow in that second panel on page 5.
Well, I guess he won't be brushing them with a Green Lantern construct then.
No, I suppose not. page six. Wait, Guy forgot to... He just left Hector there?
Yeah, that's so weird. I hope they come back to that.
I have to imagine that they will at some point, but right now he's just like sitting out there on a tropical island, as far as I can tell. It could just be a beach. I'm not really sure. I'm envisioning it as a tropical island. And he's just got that same Hector Hammond look on his face, like a deer in headlights, because he can't move. He can't do anything. You know, if somebody doesn't come by and give him water in a few days, he's going to die. So I really am curious to see what they end up doing with him to make this work.
He'll warp time back over itself to get himself back in the institution.
There has to be something set up here, because there's no reason to have him be on the team until he says, no, I'll be the leader. And Guy's like, no, darn you, I'm not going to let you be the leader. I'm the leader. You're stuck here now. I'm going to get Goldface instead. He's way better than you. There's got to be some reason why he's there. But yeah, they're just leaving Hector there, and I really hope that it does come back to something, because there has to be a reason for him to be there. And we're not getting it right now.
Right.
Page seven. Hal and the others are on the moon Charon, Charon. It's pronounced Charon, which is the only known moon of Jupiter in 1985. And which is kind of funny, because last week in real life, as we're recording this, or about a month ago, no, sorry, 2 weeks ago, as this episode is released, the fourth moon of Pluto was discovered. But it is described as being the only moon of Pluto, so it's just kind of interesting to think about things in those terms. Page nine. Yep, that's Guy Gardner. And here he is, just, you know, not taking any crap from anybody, just calling Hal Jordan a jerk because he himself is a jerk, and that's how he describes other people. But that was page nine. So page 13, the Guardians disagree with John when he shows up and tries to tell them the things that Sinestro was just saying. But one of them is saying, you know, it's not up to us to alter destiny by stopping Guy Gardner and Hal Jordan. But they sent them. Oh, it just comes down to one of those things like that Terry Schiavo problem. Do you remember this at all? Where Terry Schiavo was a woman who was on a feeding tube and respirator because she would not survive without them. She was in some sort of a brain dead coma, and there was this big debate as to whether or not they should intervene by removing the food tube. And when it comes down to it, they were really intervening by putting in the food tube. So that's basically what we get here. Pay no attention to my dogs barking in the background.
Bark.
They sent Guy and Hal to do it. It's not altering destiny to stop them. Sorry, that's the end of my rant on that. Page 14, I was really shocked because, wow, I, as the reader, actually believed Sinestro. That he was doing right by the universe.
Never believe Sinestro.
Well, I know. Never believe Sinestro, but he's just that charismatic that he actually fooled me as the reader.
Never believe Sinestro unless he tells you to never believe him.
Yes, exactly. Or if he says, trust me. But in the end, on page 14, I feel lied to by the villain, and that's not cool. Villain lied to me. Moving ahead a few pages, page 19, the hole in the black beyond is the sort of wormhole that brings you to the antimatter universe. Well, I can guarantee you it's not a black hole, because it's more like a gay hole. It's very colorful.
Wow, that... Okay, that moving right along.
That was not making fun of gay people at all.
Moving
right along. Page 23, I knew that Hal was going to have trouble taking orders from Guy. But dude, quitting being a Green Lantern, just like, okay, I've had enough of this, I quit. Because he's not going to take any of the crap from Guy. I don't really get that. But then on page 24, this is why Guy is a bad leader. They're right there fighting the Weaponers. They need him to help them fight the Weaponers, and here he is trying to kill Hal. And by the way, once the ring is taken off his finger and he doesn't have the Green Lantern bubble thing over his head, which he does have sort of an aura around him before that as well, so he is fully protected. As soon as the ring is removed, it should not take very long for him to die.
I was kind of thinking the same thing.
He should die quickly, yeah. And on page 25, I don't get it. Do they have different oaths when they charge their rings? Is that the deal? Is all the Green Lanterns are sort of reciting their oath to recharge their rings?
Yes.
And one of them's written in some weird form of Arabic?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, I can understand that on the level that it can't rhyme in every alien language. But that's about as far as I can take that.
Yeah, I like the idea that they each have their own form of the oath.
But we've
it ruins the moment when they all come together and recite, you know.
Yeah, because they would have to do all the different oaths every time that they get a group of them together.
Right.
Saw in the annual that a bunch of aliens all had the same oath.
Right.
So, well, there you go.
I do like the idea that the ring, they would each say their own form, but then the ring would translate it so that they're hearing, like if you were saying it in Arabic and Jeffrey or David was saying it in French, if I was using my ring to say it in Spanish, I would hear you guys saying it in Spanish. It would translate your language to my language.
Which means it might not rhyme.
Why did I have to have French?
But I don't know.
Mine's Indian.
But it would translate what you are saying to what I'm saying.
Okay.
Because it's all the same.
It would translate it, and I'm wondering if it will be a poetic translation where somebody takes Sophocles and translates it into English but still keeps the verse within it, or if it's one of those translations where you're translating Shakespeare to Klingon and it would have to be put into different terms and even change some of the wording so that it would actually work in the verse. And if there is rhyming, if there would be rhyming. And in this case, we have in brightest day, in blackest night, no evil shall escape my sight, and so on and so forth. We all know the oath at this point. So if it's going to be like that, if it's going to be said in an alien language, will it be poeticized so that everything rhymes and is in the perfect verse? Or will it be an alien version where it's going to be an exact replica of it? And in this case, we do get some very different oaths. And so I'm wondering if we get those different oaths because that's how it's poeticized.
I took it as we were seeing it from that Lantern's point of view.
Okay.
But when, like,
I take
the Arabic Lantern here, he is hearing John recite John's oath. John's reciting it in English, but the Arabic Lantern is hearing it in Arabic. He's hearing it like he is saying it.
Right, and again, we're substituting Arabic for whatever this language is,
right, because it's not right.
Readable, just so that everybody else is aware. But John, Cat Matui, Aresia, Tomar Ri, they have all said the main Green Lantern oath before.
Right, because from in that instance, we were getting the dialogue from John's point of view, or whatever the Earth-based Green Lantern in that scene was.
Right, and I'm not sure that we're actually disagreeing.
Either. Right.
Oh, okay.
Maybe.
So
I got lost at the onset, so
I think that we've said what we need
to
say.
Go back to France.
I surrender.
Okay, page 26 and 27. Now, with Hal, he explains that a passing Quartian was just floating by him, so he was able to grab the helmet and put it on. There are a few problems with that. Number one, you need an oxygen supply to go along with the helmet to then get rid of the vacuum of space once you put it on. You need to have opened your eyes to be able to see that happen. And for a human being to do that means that your eyes would basically freeze open. And I don't know how you would actually see out of that anymore. Wow, there are a few things wrong with this, but again, you kind of have to forgive them because they're a comic book, but I felt they bore mentioning. Page 29, everybody was kung fu fighting.
Whoa.
Exactly. It's the huge fight scene. Page 30, I actually had to put in the notes, did Zax just die?
Yeah.
And yeah, he did, and his final word was, kitschy!
That's what I want my final words to be.
I want my final words to be, I used to pee in the sink.
Say that in the wrong place, and it probably will be.
Yeah, exactly. Page 32, Hal tries to stop Guy, and I knew that this would happen when Jon Stewart said that he was going to put Guy on the moon, on the surface of the moon, where he would be, you know, quote unquote, safe. I knew that Hal would intervene as soon as Guy got down there, and clearly that's exactly what happened. Page 36, when the ring says that Jon is wearing Hal's ring, it's kind of funny and it's kind of powerful that Hal should get his own ring back and not get, you know, Tomar Rhee's ring. I am sorry to see Tomar Rhee die. May his resurrection be swift. There is the end of a crisis at this point, so I'm imagining it won't take that long. We'll see. But still, shouldn't Tomar's ring go to somebody from his own sector? Or at least if it is going to go to Jon, shouldn't it say, you are now the sector of Tomar Rhee's sector, whatever that actual number is? And the final note that I have, when I first saw on that last page that symbol, it's the infinity symbol, I thought incorrectly. I thought it was a Mobius strip.
I still think it is.
As I follow it around, it is definitely not. It is definitely two-sided, made into an infinity symbol. It is not an actual Mobius strip because you would have to tear it apart at some place and flip that over and kind of tape it back together to make it into a Mobius strip. So that's not actually what it is. It's just an infinity symbol made into 3D and actually looking very much similar to a Green Lantern style mask. And I do love the next on where it says they're finally going to go back to Zamaron. Does anybody else feel like they were in the middle of that story when they were told, no, you need to tie into Crisis now?
It would make a lot of sense.
Would. Yeah.
Given that they just abandoned that.
Exactly. I do hope that we get to do some level of an interview with Steve Englehart about that. I can't guarantee that's going to happen. It's not something I want to promise or even tease about. But if we somehow manage to do it, that has got to be one of our questions.
Oh, definitely.
But that's all I've got. So go ahead, David.
I'm totally following it around. I think – okay. I'm not going to get off the Mobius strip. This cover, actually, this is a special issue for me because I actually picked this issue up on stands when it was out, knowing very little about Green Lantern. In fact, if you go back to the first episode, I talked about picking up an issue and not having a clue what was happening. This was the one. So I knew nothing more than what
– How did you pick this up as your very first Green Lantern issue and have no clue about what's going on?
I knew about Green Lantern from –
It's a perfect entry point in that not kind of way at all.
I liked the cover. The cover drew me in. I was simply sold on that. I picked it off the spinner rack at a convenience store to keep me busy for a few hours. I ended up just kind of giving it to a friend who actually did know what was going on, but I do remember
back in recapping. So, I mean, if it is going to be your first one, it's dense, but you can still kind of follow along what's going on. And no, that's not a Mobius strip at the end.
And this was back when you could actually spend an hour reading a comic book.
Yes, especially this one. Jumping into the actual issue, pages 2 and 3, oh good, a flashback to Sinestro's origin. I was actually hoping for this because, I mean, as you mentioned, it was an entry point. It's still a bit loftier storytelling than I was ready for because this was a lot of characters. And I didn't know there was an entire core of Green Lantern. So this definitely helped it. Page 4. I'm really glad Anti-Monitor was born with his clothes and armor on. It comforts me a little bit, but the Monitor was born naked for some reason.
I was born naked.
I was too.
Okay.
I was born with a Superman suit on.
Fair enough. Page 9, this is an awesome Guy Gardner moment. Hal's being heartfelt, welcoming Guy to the fold, and Guy Gardner just throws it right back at him. I actually enjoyed that scene. And page 11, John might as well call the gathering at the bottom of the panel red shirts. There's a lot of disposable Green Lanterns, and they all look like obvious targets, but it actually was not – they weren't the ones that ended up dying.
Yeah, and it's kind of driven home when they actually pointed out, oh, and there's other people here I don't know, and you see this whole panel of Green Lanterns.
page 12, I'm reminded that Green Lantern fans really had a reason – they had no reason to read Crisis – which is kind of a compliment, actually, because now we can't get a crossover in a regular book without being required to read the core miniseries for the event, at least one or two tie-in miniseries. So you could actually stay with this one book and get all the information you really – well, kind of all the information you needed.
Really a catch-22. I mean, they want people to read the crossovers, and if you have them completely disconnected, then, like you said, there's no reason to go read it. But – They get to a point where they're so intertwined that you absolutely have to read both or you don't know what's going on. And I think both are, from their standpoint, having them completely separate is bad, but from a reader standpoint, having them so intertwined, that's bad too. They need to strike a balance.
Yeah.
Yeah, I completely agree. And in fact, it's a very interesting point that David was making there, is that you really don't have to have read Crisis to read the Green Lantern books. And that's very interesting to me because it's very, very true. But if you read Crisis on Infinite Earths, it needs to stand on its own. Any crossover that has its own main title, I'm not talking about imprints where there's some story going on that's spanning many books and doesn't even have a main title.
Like Outworlds at War.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But in this case, something like Crisis on Infinite Earths, or if you were to take any other really big story, like the next big one is going to be Legends. And when you get to Legends, Legends can be read on its own. And the outer books, I don't know about all of them. I know that the Superman ones can essentially be read on their own without reading Legends as well. I think I do kind of prefer the idea that you kind of need to read the... at least the main title of the crossover, if there is a main title. That's just kind of my feeling on it, because if you're just reading Green Lantern, go ahead and read Crisis on Infinite Earths. Go ahead and read Legends. I know that by the time we get to Millennium, you're going to have to read Millennium.
Mm-hmm.
But that makes perfect sense.
Well, Millennium is sort of pivotal for the Green Lanterns. So.
Yeah. It's a Green Lantern story that ended up crossing over into the entire rest of the DC universe. But that's further down the road. So yeah, it is a very interesting balance, and it's very tricky, and they're playing with some ideas here. But yeah, you do not need to read Crisis on Infinite Earths to enjoy any of the if you were to read all of the Green Lantern books. All the story that you really need to know is here. Which is helpful when you're podcasting and don't want to read all of Crisis on Infinite Earths all over again.
Yeah.
Right, David?
Yeah, I'd prefer not to. page 16. Now we all remember. We get this one small suggestion, and some of the people are starting to get on the same page with what the Green Lantern battery is saying. Now, I can tell you that Jeffrey and I went downtown to L.A., and we were freak dancing with MASH's Gary Berghoff, and you might think you remember that, but it doesn't mean we actually freak danced with Gary Berghoff.
Even though we did.
Yeah. page 18.
I've actually never been to L.A.
I haven't either.
Okay.
Well, I can't tell you about L.A., but I know that if you go to San Francisco, you have to be sure to wear some flowers in your hair.
page 18. I'm actually quite fascinated with the lion-like quadruped Green Lantern in panel 4. And that's one of the elements that I really enjoy about Green Lantern, especially wanted to go back and reread a lot of these, because when we come to scenes on Oa, there's all kinds of new aliens to check out, different renditions of Green Lantern, which makes, you know, the character, the concept that much more dense.
Which Green Lantern are you talking about? Page 18?
Panel in the middle, right in the middle of the page across the...
Okay,
yeah.
I was looking at the bottom panel. I see.
It's Green Lantern Aslan.
Simba.
There you go.
Yes, Simba, you are watching CNN.
Nice. Page 20, I'm glad we got the description of what it feels like to go through the void as the characters are actually going through it, because A, the descriptions are actually really good. They form a solid narration. And B, we move this necessary little step along a little bit faster. So I was actually glad that we condensed that. Page 21, Sham is now my new personal favorite sound effect.
Sham!
Yeah. oh, wow. Yeah, page 23, Hal Jordan quits. That's a shocker.
Yeah, that hasn't happened before.
Yeah. page 20. Yeah, well, there you go. Page 25, I love this moment. This is where the book really amps up in the intensity and we know something big is about to happen. It's all starting to – you can feel that everything is about to come together right here.
Well, they did do a double-sized issue for issue 198.
Yeah, well, that should have been a should have been a flag right there. Yeah, once again, like you, Jeffrey, I'm going to call crap on the whole Hal grabbing the nearby weaponer's helmet. I mean, the vacuum should have crushed Hal in about half a second. But I'm going to give – I'm just – for my own peace of mind, I'm going to say, oh, the antimatter universe, the physics work a little bit different, and just leave it at that.
Well, basically, the way that it should work in space is that you could actually survive for a matter of seconds. We're talking about, like, between 5 and 8. And that's only if you didn't have any air in your lungs. If you had any air in your lungs when the Green Lantern ring is taken off, then your blood will immediately boil. And in fact, that's basically what happens. And it's kind of freeze boils and turns into a solid. Ugh. And if you are able to get all the oxygen out of your system as at least as much as possible, then the vacuum effect actually has a slightly slower effect.
So you're basically miserable longer.
Yeah, it's different from, for instance, going underwater where you would want to take a great big gulp of breath first. If you're in space, that's actually the worst thing you could do.
Ooh. Okay. I stand by. Okay, so he actually could have had potentially the chance, assuming that he had no breath in him, to grab the helmet.
And assuming that he opened his eyes to see the Quardian float by, and he had that like little tenth of a second before his eyes completely froze over. Because remember, it is close to absolute zero in space.
So if all those really, really unlikely things happen, sure.
Oh, wait, we're reading a comic book. I forgot. I'm sorry.
True. We're thinking a little... Sorry. That's me. I think about these things. Page 30, the death of Zax.
I think it's a
valid point. Okay, thank you. The death of Zax was... Is Joss Whedon writing this? Because it's so unexpected.
Is Preston writing this?
If it was Joss Whedon, Jon Stewart would be a woman.
Fair enough.
When it comes to live action, if you're going to kill somebody quickly so that it has an effect, like, you know, anybody can die, that Joss Whedon has handled that quite well. Mm-hmm. And when it came to Grant Morrison doing it in Final Crisis, killing off Martian Manhunter, that it did not feel like, oh, this is happening so fast. I mean, this can happen to anybody. Anybody can die. That when he did it in Final Crisis, to me, it felt much more like, oh, I really need to kill off John Jones. John Jones is what I meant, not John Stewart.
Yeah.
Because that's what it was.
That's exactly what it was.
Joss puts in his time, mm-hmm. and other writers too, but, you know, since we're comparing those two, Joss puts in his time and he makes you... He builds up the characters and he makes you feel their death when it happens. That didn't happen with Final Crisis. It was just done for the show of it.
For Joss Whedon, when the character who I don't want to say in case anybody hasn't seen it yet... There is a character who is going to die in Avengers, and when it happens, it is very jarring, and it's made to be very jarring, and it's done well. If you go back and watch Serenity, which is sort of the film that takes place after the Firefly series, which was cut short, then there's a death that happens towards the end of that, which does an amazing job of making the audience believe, or at least me and the audience believe, that anybody can die. And I think that that's the point. And when you get to people like Grant Morrison, who did it with Final Crisis, and it just did not work, because it was clear exactly what it was that he was trying to say, that anybody could die. That's very similar to what we get here with Zax, because all that we get is just Zax gets shot with a yellow beam in one panel and he says, ka-chee!
Yeah.
And that's its ending.
Yeah, and it really was, too. And the thing is, it's kind of an odd death, because according to research done by movie studios, people have real issues when an animal is killed. I mean, most movies, you'll see no issues killing off a human, but you won't see a domestic animal like a dog or a cat will not be shown on screen dying most of the time.
Like an Old Yeller?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, and like, they didn't show it in Old Yeller. They showed the kid, Travis, shooting the dog, and they had a close-up of him, and then the shot goes off, but it doesn't leave his face.
Mm-hmm.
But here, we are not really talking about a domestic animal. We're talking about a grasshopper.
True, but he's an
acute grasshopper.
But he's cute, he's anthropomorphic, and he's a character that gets gunned down, and we even get blood.
That I've seen a grasshopper's death be even remotely sad was in the movie Short Circuit.
Reassemble.
Exactly. Reassemble, Stephanie. Reassemble.
But it was, I guess the closest I can put it is, it was like a Disney character getting killed more blatantly than you would normally see. Like, you know, Mufasa got, we know what happened to Mufasa, we don't see it happen. But the suddenness and just the fact that it was Zax, who is this small, kind of unassuming character, made it that much more, you know, stop and stare.
Yeah, I suppose it would be one thing if it had happened in, like, A Bug's Life,
mm-hmm.
which was based on Seven Samurai. So really, two of those bugs should have died.
Only two?
Based on Seven Samurai.
Okay, I'm going by Magnificent Seven. Which was also based on Seven Samurai.
Seven Samurai, yeah. And in Seven Samurai, two of them died. In A Bug's Life, none of them did.
Okay.
But it's a kid's movie, so they can't have Zax die.
True. page 34. In the present, you know that Guy respects John. These two have not an admiration, but they may be contemptuous, but at the end of the day, they will get each other's back. They respect each other. This is the moment that is created.
Right.
Because Guy suddenly looks and goes, oh, okay, you're actually worth your salt. And John really is, too. John really steps up, and this is the issue that I think is probably the biggest turning point for him as far as long-term Green Lantern prowess. Finally, to wrap up, page 35, to kind of fill you in, the bright lights, the shaking, this is the moment in Crisis on Infinite Earths number 12 when the Earth 2 Superman decides he's had enough. He finally snaps and literally beats the Anti-Monitor into pieces as the universes finally merge into one and create a new one. And the explosion we see is the death of the Anti-Monitor. But it does make the issue feel like it just kind of stops at the climax. You know, we've got everything. We're right up to the pitch moment, you know, that moment. And it's like, oh, look at the lights in the sky. Everything must be fine now.
Which one? What was the order that they came out in, Crisis 12 and this one, like release date wise? Do you know off the top of your head?
I do not, but we can find out.
We can find out.
We have the technology. Crisis on Infinite Earths number 12 came out on November 28th of 1985. This came out on December 12th, 1985. So Crisis was about a month, just short of a month's difference.
So Crisis came out first?
Correct.
Okay. So Crisis was over by the time this hit the stands?
Correct. So it was...
Which makes perfect sense.
Yeah. But they don't telegraph it, but it does feel like we get right to that point. We don't exactly... I'm in a line of dialogue. But I guess really with what we're doing, the Crisis is... Well, not secondary. It's in the background. So, I'm kind of on the fence about that. It felt like we could have gotten something, but at the same time, I was generally satisfied with the issue. And hey, Hal's back.
Hmm.
And it's very special. This is actually a very special issue to revisit. I'm glad to come back to it where I have all the pieces in place. And really, with that exception of the sudden stop, the issue was really on taking us to a next level where things came to the head all at once, and we're about to jump into a completely, very, very soon, a completely different direction that I'm really excited about.
Yeah.
But that's all I got.
Cool. Well, there was nothing in the letters column of note that I noticed, but there were some other, a few other Green Lantern appearances and books released during the time period we covered in this episode. The Green Man continues to be involved with the Omega Men in issues 34 through 36 of that title, as well as a guest appearance in New Teen Titans number 16. Jon Stewart had some very minor cameos in Infinity Inc. number 22 and All-Star Squadron number 53. Those were both Crisis tie-in books, and Jon's appearance is very, very minor. I don't even think he has any dialogue in either one. But in the All-Star Squadron 53, there's a scene where he and Alan Scott are shown shaking hands, which is notable since I think that would be their first meeting.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
True, especially since Alan Scott, up until the Crisis, was an Earth 2 character.
Yeah. Yeah, it would have been neat to see a story with just those two, either meeting for the very first time or just teaming up. I mean, I don't think there's ever been a story like that, even, you know, going forward.
I think that they do end up meeting up, but it's not like a big team-up or right. anything like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we also had issues 11 through 13 of Who's Who in the DC Universe, which included profiles of Infinity Inc., only important because of the inclusion of Jade, who got her own profile in issue 13, and Obsidian. But Jade and Obsidian are the kids of Alan Scott, who we really won't be talking about too much in the show, but Jade does come into the books in a fairly significant fashion way down the road. And there was also profiles of the Injustice Gang, including the Tattooed Man, the Invisible Destroyer, the Javelin, yes, the Javelin got his own profile, the Justice League of America and Justice Society of America, which included Hal Jordan and Alan Scott respectively, and Krona, which surprisingly doesn't mention anything about his involvement in Crisis.
So it is Krona. I said Kronos in my synopsis. I apologize.
Different character. So any final comments?
I think I've said everything I need to say.
Yeah, right. Yep, same here. Just looking forward to next episode as well.
You guys realize we are halfway to Millennium?
I'm not surprised.
From where we started to Millennium, we are halfway there.
No, we're making a good clip, really. If you look at it, what we're covering roughly 3 months at a time. We're really blowing through these.
Yeah. Well, speaking of moving at a clip, next episode we're actually going to kind of put a little bit of a break on that because we're only covering two issues, Green Lantern 199 and Green Lantern 200. The way the stories fall and the change that happens after 200, we thought it'd be better to just cover those two issues so we could kind of start fresh with episode 12. But issue 200 is double-sized, so there will be the same amount of podcastery goodness for your money. But,
and if we need to fill some space, we will talk about Green Giant and Green Eggs and Ham.
Exactly. But until then, this is Michael Bradley.
And Jeffrey
Taylor. David. I'm that guy, other guy.
I'm Jeff.
Oh, nice lady.
My name is Michael Bradley.
Let's try that. I'm J. David Weider.
I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
And we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening to another episode of Green Lantern's Light, hosted by Michael Bradley,
Jeffrey Taylor,
and J. David Weider. Show notes, past episodes, and other information about the show can be found at greenlanternslight.com. You can also subscribe to the show directly via the RSS feed and on iTunes.
If you'd like to get in touch with the show, drop us a line to greenlanternpodcast@gmail.com or use the contact form at the website. You can also follow the show on Facebook and Twitter to get updates and interact with us directly. Let us know your thoughts, and we might even read your message on a future episode.
Green Lantern and all related elements are copyright DC Comics. We hope you've enjoyed this episode and that you'll come back next month. But until then,
in brightest day,
in blackest night.
no evil shall escape our sight.
Let those who worship evil's might
beware our power.
Green Lantern's light.
What was that?
Nothing. Yeah.
If
carry on. Never mind.
Did somebody just kill a vampire?
It was Abraham Lincoln. He's here. Oh, okay. He's spending the night with me. He's my house guest.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.